and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. I'm delighted to announce that this series of Serious Influence is being exclusively sponsored by our very own tech platform, the Blogosphere Network. The Blogosphere Network is a platform where brands and influencers can feedback on what it was actually like to work with each other on campaigns. Real, qualitative data. If you'd like a demo of the service, please drop us an email at info@blogosphere.biz. That's info@blogosphere.biz. It's time to bring back the human touch to this human industry. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by YouTuber Katie Snooks. Katie has been involved in the world of social media since 2009, when she started blogging. In 2012, she joined Gleam Digital and saw the company shift from producing content for brands' social feeds to becoming the talent management company it is today, Gleam Futures. Katie produces relatable content across her channels, from videos about acne to dating. And it is this raw content that has given her such a strong and engaged audience.
I'm Katie. I'm a YouTuber, blogger, Instagrammer. I've had a blog for 10 years now, a really long time. And I've been full-time doing YouTube for about 3 years. So, yeah.
How did you first stumble into the world of blogging?
I was at uni. I was doing a photography degree. And at the same time, I was absolutely obsessed with makeup. I remember not buying any beauty products unless I'd read like at least 10 reviews on them beforehand. And so there are a couple of blogs that I read and I was just like, I love this, I could do this. So literally just started a free blog writing about my favorite makeup or how amazing this lipstick is. It was really like simple, but I found it really relaxing. And yeah, from that it just became something I did at every given free opportunity.
So when you finished university, what was the first job that you went into?
So doing a photography degree, that was a big part of my blog as well. So I loved photographing the makeup, but I actually did a lot of photography internships after university. So I did an internship at the Tate Modern, which was amazing. Got to exhibit in that, which was great. I really like photographing people. And so I did just loads of that. But then as I was also blogging on the side, I started doing some freelance consulting for beauty startup companies using my social media expertise that I'd kind of self-learn along the years of blogging.
So was that the first way that you were bringing in some revenue as a result of your blog through consultancy?
Yeah, so at this point, I think I must have had my blog for about 2 or 3 years. And I had started making a tiny bit of money doing sponsored work. But I remember I went back through my emails a while ago and found my first sponsored post was like £30. And I was so excited. So yeah, I was kind of doing a bit of that here and there, working for brands that I absolutely loved and just writing reviews up for them.
What was that £30 campaign?
It might have been No. 7, reviewing my face cream, and I had to drag my mum into it to review it for me on my blog as well. But yeah, they were great brands, but it was all so new back then and no one really knew kind of how to price it or how much it was worth in terms of engagement. And at that time in my life, I kind of had my fingers in loads of different pies. I also did a bit of acting on the side as well. So just loads of little freelance jobs here and there. And yeah, I loved it. I loved just being creative and yeah, get my hands stuck in.
So this is in 2009 when you're doing the blog. That's when you started.
Yeah, started the blog around 2009. And then I was doing all of this kind of freelance stuff up until 2012. Graduated 2011. And then I was like, right, I am making a tiny bit of profit from my blog, so I should actually spend some proper time, like dedicate actual days a week to doing this. whilst I do retail work and freelance stuff here and there. And so, yeah, I started putting a little bit more hours in, but also still needed a good regular income. So that was when I applied for a part-time job at a company called Gleam.
Oh, Gleam. You mentioned that you did this £30 campaign with Number 7 that was a right through blog post and testing it out. Had display ads on blogs started at that point? Because that was quite a big revenue driver for a while, but now that's sort of died a death, hasn't it not?
Yeah, it's really interesting that I don't have any kind of standalone blog ads on my blog or anywhere, I guess YouTube. But yeah, that was a good source of kind of regular income. It was very low back then, but it was a tiny bit that could, yeah, it helped. But sponsored work was when the kind of, I wouldn't say big money, but it started, yeah, becoming a bit more worthwhile, I guess. But I didn't really do it for the money either. It was more of a passion. I did it for, yeah, like 3 or 4 years before I started making money enough to be able to do it full time.
That was a time when I suppose people didn't really realise what it was going to become anyway.
Yeah, we were just a bunch of people who absolutely loved beauty products and loved talking about them online. And it was such a nice time back then because it really felt like a big community of girls. And it's so lovely to see those girls still going strong with it all today as well. It's really inspiring.
Do you think that now we're in second, third generation influencer and many people are starting knowing that it can become a career, that this has actually caused the mass lack of trust that the industry is facing at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I remember friends coming up to me and seeing how successful my blog had been and seeing that I was making a nice amount of money from it or being able to live comfortably for it. And they'd be like, I want to start a blog. I can do that as well. And then they'd give up after like a month because they weren't seeing any gain from it. I don't think you can start something like this unless you're absolutely passionate and committed to it. I think commitment is one of the biggest things that someone could go into knowing and want to succeed to have a blog, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think there has been a brief kind of window in time over the last 2 years, though, where people can monetize at all different levels and no matter how long you've been doing, which has obviously fed into this sort of problems that we have with fraud and that, you know, when you started out, you had those long organic relationships with brands and then they became monetized. But now we've had this window where anyone can make money and people are buying followers and then just putting them through apps. But I feel like we're coming out the other side of that now and actually we're returning to people realizing that you need sort of brand ambassadors and longer term relationships. We'll talk a bit more about that in the future because I feel like we need to go back to 2011 and you've applied to a part-time job at Gleam, which started in 2010. So you must have been one of the first.
Yeah, so I started in the summer of 2012 as a part-time kind of 3 days a week. And the company back then was really different. Dom, the MD, he managed a handful of really incredible talent like Tanya Burr and Jim and Ruth Crilly and Pixie Wu. And I came along as kind of the creative for community management. Gleam back then was Gleam Digital, so it was big brand focus. So managing brand social media, their blogger outreach, creative pitching and the new social world. And Dom was amazing at recognising that that was going to be a thing. So yeah, started that, loved it. I had some amazing clients that I worked with. And as the company grew and I went full time with them, the company really just shifted and started taking on a lot more social talent. And that was when the switch over to Gleam Futures happened.
So it sort of pivoted from managing brand social medias to becoming talent management.
Yeah. And it was incredible to watch. And no one, I mean, Dom's amazing, but no one would have imagined that it would be the incredible thing it is today.
So who was on the sort of roster then? And when was the year? Was it sort of 2014? I feel like that's when Gleam was just everywhere in all articles about this new movement.
Yeah, so I remember 2013, the summer of, that was when we were working in an office in a basement in Covent Garden. That was when Zoe Sugg and Joe and Alfie and that whole new bunch of incredible people came to Gleam and started hanging out in the basement with us, like editing as they went. And from that, 2013 onwards, was just an explosion of just great UK, British YouTubers doing amazing things, and Gleam supported them through all of that, and it was, yeah, incredible to watch.
What were your responsibilities at that time at work?
So I was definitely more of a creative. I was all for logistics, and I would always watch the talent producers and talent managers doing their thing and organizing these amazing, like, big brand campaigns. And I was quite good at coming up with maybe some of the ideas of content that brands could do with the talent, but also I was a new talent scout, so I would kind of put decks together. The thing is as well, I was very in the community, so I knew who the up-and-coming bloggers and people were to look out for. So yeah, I'd always put decks together for Dom to look at new talent. I would organise like blogger campaigns. We did a lot with Avon, so I would organise creative blogger outreach for them and a lot of Unilever brands as well. So I ran like Tresemme's Twitter page and then like organised blogger events and packages sent out to it, and it was amazing, like collecting reviews. I loved it because I was in the community and on the brand side as well, and it was great to see.
Do you think that if you hadn't have left to go full time, that perhaps being at a media agency would have been a good move for you, because then you'd have got the creative and been able to oversee those campaigns?
Yeah, and it's really interesting as well, because I left Gleam, I handed my notice in, but I didn't leave for until at least 6 months after that, because we were trying to fill my position at the company and it was just impossible. I think because I'd been at the company for so long and it evolved so much since then, I really was able to make that role perfect for me. So I also did video editing. I helped with a lot of e-commerce. I remember Marcus Butler opened an e-commerce store and it was like one of the first, and I'd help
him. Was
that
for his merchandise?
Yeah, his own merch brand. And I shot the campaign and then helped, I guess, kind of build the website or manage the website, that e-commerce store. And then like Tanya released her makeup range and I did some work with her to like help choose shades and name the products. Oh, I just felt so lucky to be able to do that job, because it was everything that I absolutely loved doing. Talking to bloggers, finding new ones, being creative, doing some photography, doing video editing. And so when it came to leave, I couldn't find anyone to do the job. And so I think that was when Gleam and I decided, right, it's time to say goodbye to Gleam Digital and focus solely on futures.
And what year was that?
That was 2015.
So when you got to the point where you were like, I'm going to leave, those crossroads, what was going through your mind? Like, why did you just decide? Was it because your own stuff was just doing so well?
Yeah, partly that, but also, if I'm being completely honest, I was absolutely jealous of seeing these so jealous of seeing these amazing opportunities for content creators that Gleam were managing, and knowing that I could also do those as well. It was really sad because I loved that job and I loved the company and the people there, but I also really loved doing my own thing. And I did that constantly. Like, I'd work full time, then go home and write my blog and film videos and edit all weekend. And I just decided, like, I want to dedicate full time to my own stuff now.
And then did you get signed by Gleam straight away?
I did.
That's nice.
Yeah. I was actually really cheeky. I presented a new deck of talent to Dom and I snuck myself in at the end and was like, the time has come. It was really, I remember the day so clearly. It was really sad. Like, Dom has always been so supportive and was very lucky to have been signed by them straight away.
I think what is so special about the Gleam talent, obviously it was the first roster of people that it was like, wow, this is actually an industry. But so many are so entrepreneurial, like you mentioned Marcus doing his first e-commerce site. Do you think that that is just something that's been overlooked across social media, that actually people are running their own brands and are very entrepreneurial?
Yeah, I think anyone that starts a blog and is able to go full-time from it, or a YouTube channel, they are massive business people and they don't get that recognition. I think it's very easy to look at them and be like, oh, you just take nice pictures for Instagram, or oh, you just film yourself in your bedroom and stick that up online. It's so much more than that. It's chatting to brands, making good relationships with brands. It's writing content, editing, filming, knowing enough about camera equipment and microphones. And then all the ideas kind of underneath that, like content strategies and pitching to brands with ideas. And they are business people, entrepreneurs for sure.
When you got signed, what was the split in you going after brand deals and Gleam giving you brand deals?
I can't quite remember, but I had been doing it for such a long time anyway. I had a really great amount of relationships with amazing brands that I'd worked with already. So I think it was pretty even in terms of them introducing me to new clients, but they would manage everything.
How has that developed over the years? How have you seen influencer talent management change? At the beginning, it was very much maybe the contracts and going out and finding the deals. And now a few people are bringing management in-house. So
Yeah, I find it so interesting bringing management in-house. I mean, talking for myself, but I'm awful with contracts and money and negotiating. So having a company that is able to do that for me is just incredible. I also think it's really inspiring when bloggers have their own teams working on things with them. It's changed a lot, but it's, I think, gone in a really natural direction of people taking ownership for what they can do and what they have and making it into a thing.
And you have a team that know what campaigns you'd like to do. Does every campaign that comes through that could be for you get shown to you, or is there a palming off of ones that aren't going to be relevant? And when a campaign does come to you, what are the type of deliverables or like briefs that really stand out to you and make you want to do them? Obviously, having been in the creative side before, you probably can write good campaigns yourself. So then on the flip side of that, what campaigns land, maybe that's just into your inbox and not through management, that are just like no-nos?
I think...
So good campaign brief first.
Yeah. I think what makes an amazing campaign brand and one that makes me really excited is one that... It's so interesting because basically us influencers, we know what gets the best engagement. We know what our audience want to watch and we know what will perform the best. So a brand that appreciates that and acknowledges that and knows that we have a lot of expertise in our content and what will work well. So one that will allow us to come up with our own creative and roll with it and be a lot like very chilled out about it. I think those are ones that excite me a lot. A brand will come to me and say, we have this product. Have you tried it before? Do you like it? If so, would you like to work with us? Like, these are our key messagings that we would like to get across. Do you have ideas on what we could do? Those are the ones where I'm like, yes, can't wait to get my fingers stuck into this. Love the product. Have bought it myself anyway. I know how my audience would also enjoy me showing this content. And yeah, those are the ones that really excite me.
Do you feel that's been a bit of a learning curve for brands over the past few years, and that there was a bit more resistance being like, no, this is the caption?
Yeah, and it still is. You'd be surprised. It really still is now with some brands. I was talking to my manager the other day and I was kind of like, I don't want to do any more jobs like this because I know that they won't perform well. And that's, I'd never want to feel embarrassed about something that I've done, even if I love the product. So yeah, it's kind of making decisions like that.
How much feedback do you get after you've done a campaign?
I'd like more, I think. I love it when Gleam come back to me and they're like, oh, the brand really loved this. I've had a brand send me a card before saying that they really liked the work that I did with them. And that always means so much. Also, because this industry is so lonely as well, I think people forget that. We're working by ourselves a lot and day to day, and there's no one telling us that we're doing a good job or that. I mean, our audience are doing that, but it's easier to take on all the negatives than the positives sometimes in that sense.
Did management ever come back and say, oh, the brand would have liked to have seen more of this, so that you can, you know, constructive criticism? Or is it?
No, I think that would come back in the kind of sign-off stage.
How does it actually work then? Yeah, from start to finish, the campaign brief comes, you accept, then what happens?
Yeah, so the brand will go to Gleam. They'll ask me if I like the product, if I would like to work with them. They run up a brief. I sign that brief off and ask any questions and stuff like that. Create the content. Content sent over to the brand. Feedback is given. Normally the feedback is allowed to be like only edits and not to be refilmed. And then if that's all good, then it gets signed off. And yeah, we decide on when we would like to upload it, or the brand do if there's a deadline.
And then during your time, like full-time influencer, not only have you done brand partnerships, but you've used some of the platforms, I believe, as well. Were you not stung by Mode Media Claps?
Oh, That was awful.
I feel like it was your tweet that was like, I've been left severely out of pocket here.
Yeah, I did a job with Mode Media and it was my biggest job to date. And I was so excited about that campaign and it went really well. And the company went into bankruptcy and I never received a penny of it. And that was awful.
Wasn't it like 6 months rent or something?
Oh, yeah. It was a nice deposit for, yeah, something.
With agencies like that, and we have seen it actually across the board, it's not just Mode. We've seen Defy Media go down. We've seen Brand New IO not paying creators. What are your views on those platforms and why do you think they are getting it wrong?
I'm not quite sure. I think a lot of companies like that, they are the in-betweeners. I think the brand could have gone directly to Gleam in my case and the job would have got done a lot quicker and that wouldn't have happened. So maybe there's less of a need for them. I'm not entirely sure on that.
I do think that when that happens, it's not only damaging for the brand's reputation, obviously it's very damaging for the influencer as well. So that direct partnerships, do you think we'll be seeing more direct partnerships as this industry grows?
Yeah, I hope so. I think there's also going to be a big thing for like longer term brand deals and brand partnerships. I mean, celebs have big brand partnerships with companies and I think that's the way that influencers go in as well.
In terms of the ads that we are seeing across social media and how supportive from a community's perspective, I remember interviewing Victoria in the Throw in series one and she said, you know, likes have become a bit more like a currency. What's kind of happening with ads in the space?
It's really interesting we're talking about this now after this whole new thing about the ASA and the CAP and
CMA. Oh, Commission, so many. Advertising Practice, Competition and Markets Authority, Advertising Standards
Agency.
Authority. Oh God, the SA. Sorry, Reaper.
Yeah, I think this is really, it's very frustrating for me and a lot of us influencers, I think, because we've always been really transparent about ads and the work we do. And this has kind of thrown a spanner into the works. I think I was reading through the influencer guide for ASA best practice and it's kind of looking like it's going to be going that everyone's just going to have to put ad on everything if we get gifted a product, even though the brand hasn't paid us any monetary value or
hasn't taken any editorial control or anything.
Yeah.
But even if you've worked with them in the last 12 months on a different campaign, despite you going out and buying something by yourself because you already had that previous relationship, then you need to declare it as gifted.
Yeah. So they had like a flow chart in this new document and it was like, have you been given a product for free? Yes. Have the brand had any creative control? No. This is sponsored, but you can't say sponsored. You've got to say ad. So it's like everything is an ad. It's really interesting because my whole audience and a lot of our audience know it's very obvious that we get sent a lot of products to our PO boxes and that we are gifted a lot of things. And we've never really hidden that. We've always been really obvious. I have. Oh, this came in the post today. Look how amazing this is. So I think what I predict is going to happen is there's going to be a real overload of ad, so much so that it's going to take away from actually what is paid for content. I think the consumers are going to get very confused about it all and hopefully the companies will have to have a rejig of what's really important here.
Yeah, I think it is in the way that people are declaring as well, because when you do just have to use the same term, ad, that is confusing. I mean, some people are doing ad gifted.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're declaring it saying these products were sent to me, how much more obvious can you be anyway? Do you need to have the huge ad at the front? In some ways, I do think that it's a good sign that people are making this much of a fuss, as in the CMA, because it means that they're actually registering that this is an industry and that we need to professionalise it. And if we do professionalise, then it secures it for the good people.
Yeah.
And we do need to protect it. But I think that with anything, it's just the, you know, you've had your big wave and now the seas need to calm. To use a weird analogy. Do you think that because these new guidelines have come in, that the way your views on doing press have changed? Like, if you get sent something, are you more likely not to cover it now because you don't want to have to put ad gifted, even though before, be like, oh, this was sent to me and I really like it?
I was having a chat with my partner about this last night and he was like, well, what if a brand sends you it and then you love it so much, but you don't want to put ad, so you go out and buy the product then? What does that mean? I don't think it would stop me talking about things. I think it would maybe be that I have to throw and chuck all of that kind of content into one video maybe, or one post, to save my entire feed of content being overwhelmed with ad. So maybe doing more like PR unboxings again. They used to be a big thing and that could be a big thing again, I guess. But if it has a big old ad slashed in front of it, then will it perform as well? I'm not really sure.
In terms of brands wanting to work with you, are there specific channels within your brand that they want to access? Or do you find that campaigns are mainly, you know, across YouTube and Instagram? And in terms of the budgets, are budgets normally higher for YouTube than an Instagram post? Because I feel like in the last sort of 18 months, we've definitely had Instagram. Yeah. And I feel like this year we actually may see a bit of a tail off on Instagram and maybe a bit of a pushback to YouTube and that storytelling. What are your views on that?
That's really exciting to me. Instagram, I love it, but it really does get on my nerves. I think the algorithm changes has made it so hard to grow and to reach an audience. And is it worth paying a lot of money as a brand to potentially not even reach all of that? I'm really excited about the fact that YouTube could start getting, I don't know, it's a lot more personal. I find YouTube has a lot better engagement.
It's got better trackability as well, I suppose, at the moment. What's your favourite brand campaign that you've ever worked on?
That's a really good question. I've actually got to say a job that I did in 2017 with Fiat.
Was that design your own car?
No, it was fashion content around their 500 kind of summer pastel shades, and love pastel, love fashion. Fiat was the brand of my first ever car, so I kind of already had that fondness of the brand. They were really like lax with the creative. They were just like, go and create a fashion video around the pastel colours of our car. And I teamed up with Kyle Galvin, and shot this incredible lookbook in London.
Oh, I remember it now.
It was so fun. It was just really creative, and I feel like I really put my own stamp on it, and it was just a brilliant brand to work with. A job done very well, I think.
Someone only recently said that their favourite brand campaign was with Citroën.
Oh.
So it is funny, isn't it? How, you know, you wouldn't automatically think car would be great, you know, unless it was sort of not someone doing
sexy.
The engine. Exactly. Yeah. But you can lend that voice. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm also doing a job right now, which I'm really excited about. I've recently started doing a little bit more adult content on my channel. Like I said, I've been doing this for such a long time now, and my audience have grown up with me. I don't want to talk about lipsticks constantly because there's so much more that I'm interested and passionate about. So I've started talking a lot more about dating and relationships and lifestyle and sex. So I'm working with Love Honey. They've got like a new subscription box, and I'm going to be one of the first to unbox it on YouTube. And that's just like a dream job come true, because it's something I'm passionate in. They're giving me control of how I film it, and I think that would do well. And I think the jobs that influencers are really excited about are the ones also that perform the best.
Would that type of content have been something that maybe you would have wanted to do earlier, but you were potentially worried about brand safety?
Yeah. I remember before I put my first video out with this theme, I had a bit of a breakdown. I was like, no one's going to want to work with me after this. Like, all these incredible brands that I've worked with in the past might not like this content. But also YouTube restrictions and monetizing content like that can be tricky as well. So overall, it was a risk, but I think it's paying off.
What do you actually get in this Love Honey box?
It's a secret. Yeah, it's okay. No, it's amazing. It's a massive pink silicone rabbit, and it's just lovely. I've decided, I actually text my managers at Gleam, this is probably too much information, I was like, I'm getting you all one of these for Christmas next year.
I love it. I know that we spoke earlier, but Carly, who obviously was at Gleam, did a big change in her content as well. And I think was, you know, you've seen a few people that were worried, but then it's actually had really great results. Do you think in terms of your relationship with your audience and how much of it is supportive with changing and how much of it is resisting to change? Because I feel like everybody wants you to move forward but stay exactly the same.
Yeah. The support that I've received since doing this change has been really positive. It's been really supportive. I mean, I've had a couple of comments like, this is really cringy, but I guess they're not the people I want to be watching my content anyway. I think it's really difficult for bloggers to, even with this whole kind of fast fashion thing, YouTubers create a lot of fashion hauls and people want to know where we are purchasing the things we're wearing. But then this whole fast fashion movement, so we're trying to cut back on that and restyle more fashion content, but then people get angry that they can't buy us like what we're wearing, and it's like a circle of...
You're never going to be able to please everybody.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things that I've come to realise, is that I'm never going to be able to please everyone, but as long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing and it's not awful, then I think that's the best we can do.
In the last few years, we've seen people that, you know, you're one of the originals starting in 2009, that people reach the barrier of just constantly having put so much pressure on themselves for so long that they reach burnout and do have mental health problems. Have you ever experienced problems as a result of being online, and what mechanisms do you have in place to help you with that now?
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I still get really upset when I see negative stuff about me online. It's always that thing of you pay more attention to the negatives than the positives. I guess I just reassure myself that they don't actually know who I am. And some of the stuff I've read is absolutely horrible. Like, there is a message board online dedicated to trashing YouTubers and content creators, and it's so upsetting. But yeah, just trying to kind of block that out. There's an amazing feature on YouTube where you can hide comments. So if you get something that you don't really like and makes you feel awful about yourself, you can hide that comment, and the person who commented doesn't realise that comment's been hidden. And also the block tool. Talking to other influencers as well, I guess, is a great way of realising that you're not alone in receiving negativity.
So you managed to get a thicker skin. You have no choice but to,
absolutely.
I suppose.
And I was talking to my housemate recently and she was like, I actually don't know how you do it. I think you're a lot stronger than you realise, because I certainly couldn't hear all that about myself and like sleep soundly at night time. So yeah, I guess I should...
Do you make 5-year plans, 10-year plans? Do you want your career to be social media for the foreseeable future?
This is really interesting, because I think I'm one of the only people that... I'm a massive worrier, and I know that this won't be around forever for me. I know that I've probably got a time limit on it, and so I'm just trying to really make the most of it whilst I can. I wrote a list of 5-year goals for the first time a couple of months ago, and I was like, you know what, I never let myself feel like I can do things, so let's let my hair down, let's go wild with this. Showed my managers and their response was like, yeah, that's doable. And I was like, it was really empowering, because I was like, maybe I can do these things. And yeah, I think there's a big thing in YouTubers trying to monetize off platform now. So book deals and yeah, merchandise.
Maybe you could have a sex toy range.
That is the dream. I decided I also want to write a murder mystery as well. I mean, I don't know if that would do very well. It's like not my audience and doesn't really fit in that well with what I do, but it's a dream of mine. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to add that to the list.
So in your future strategy, some of it will be, even though under your branding, you're not necessarily the brand, so you'll diversify in that way.
Yeah, I think I'm probably one of the only ones that thinks like that, because it'd be easy to write a book about dating, I think, because I make content around that and my audience would love that. But also just a passion of mine is to write a true crime novel, so.
I want to write books one day as well.
Yeah,
do it. Do you think that, you've mentioned that you feel like you have a time limit, what are your predictions for the industry as a whole?
I think this is a thing now. It's going to be around forever. I think passing knowledge on, there will always be a need for that. And the internet does that. I think this job will keep growing, and seeing how much has changed even in the last 5 years, I think it's a really exciting space. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how it evolves.
I saw a stat at the weekend. It said 14% of all UK school children desire to be a YouTuber now.
I saw that. It's amazing.
So I don't think it's going anywhere. A big thanks to Katie for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Be sure to check out blogospheremagazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?